Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. We are very lucky here to have Anna Colquhoun. Is that how you pronounce your name? Sorry, because you know I'm a little dyslexic, and Colquhoun is one of those words that has loads of Q's and H's and funny things all over the place. But hopefully that's not too much of a bashing of your name there, Anna. And we're going to talk to Anna today about Anna's life and work in Croatia. And she has a lovely, what would you describe it as, actually, Anna? What would you describe? Is it a guest house? Is it a farm? What do you describe it as?
Well, it's a very good question, because it doesn't really fit the usual models. It's a bit betwixt and between. But I mean, we normally call it a culinary guest house. It's somewhere between, I guess, a small holding or homestead and a tourism business. Culinary guest house is good.
Culinary guest house. And I love that because, of course, not of course, I mean, you won't know this, guys, but I know Anna, or at least I've attacked Anna, so to speak, because Anna had done the MA in anthropology of food. And now I understand you're doing a PhD. Is that correct?
I am. I'm supposedly nearly finished. Yeah.
Are you? Well, we'll explore that more. But basically, so there's a passion around food. And of course, for us nutritionists, that's really really relevant, not least because good food is at the heart of everything. But I'm loving also the idea of the sort of cultivation of the food and the whole concept of food coming sort of from the land. I mean, that you know where it's come from the land that you know. So tell me, sort of winding back, how did you come across? Because obviously, I say obviously, but you're from Britain, or from, are you from Britain?
How did you
end up doing this project?
Me and my partner and my husband, we're both British, but going back a few years now, I mean, at least 10, 15 years ago now, we sort of had the growing feeling that we didn't want to spend the rest of our days in the UK, as great as it can be. And we really wanted to travel, and we wanted to live abroad. And we'd done a little bit of living abroad and traveling before, and we'd noticed along our way people doing really interesting things with guest houses, actually, that they sort of managed to find themselves a really nice place to live, do something meaningful and purposeful that would bring in other people, but not in your classic kind of hotel or villa way, in a more shared social space. And we saw a few businesses like this in different countries. We were inspired by a few in particular, actually, in Turkey, in Italy, in Ghana, in a few places. And these ideas were sort of percolating in the backs of our minds, and we were building up to taking a step to leaving our jobs in the UK and doing something like this. And then after a while, we thought, well, we'll just go and have a look. And we'd made a sort of short list of a few places of interest, one of which was Istria, which is a region actually which spans sort of the northwest corner of Croatia, but also spills into Slovenia and Italy. Most of Istria is in Croatia. We thought, this part of the world, we'll just go and have a look. And of course, while we were here, we came across a house for sale, fell in love with it immediately, met the neighbours who were very enthusiastic about us buying it and doing something with it. It was a very, very old house, probably 200 or 300 years old, and had been abandoned for a long time and was falling down and was in sort of desperate need of renovation. So, I mean, it's quite a British thing, isn't it? We sort of fell in love with this ruin and wanted to do it up. So we decided there and then, actually, to put in an offer, and it was accepted, and we went ahead. And then we then spent the next 5 years renovating it. And then the 5 years after that, which is the last 5 years, we have been developing it as a business and trying to make it, as I said at the beginning, it doesn't fit the classic categories. It's not a hotel. It's not a holiday let. It's not a villa. It's a guest house. It's our home. So we live here full time. It's our home, and we share it with guests. And we also grow an awful lot of our own foods. We manage a fair amount of land around here as well. And this is for Croatia anyway. This is a bit of an unusual model. There aren't so many places doing something a bit like this. That's how we got here, and we've been here ever since.
You say sort of sharing your home. I mean, is that ever difficult? I mean, I mean, I quite like that idea of the traveller, you know, in the sort of old days where a traveller would knock at the door and you'd be kind of obliged to feed them. But obviously you do it as a business. But how do you find sharing your home?
Definitely has its pluses and minuses. I mean, I think the reason it works for us is because the year is divided into two halves. So for 6 months of the year, this place is full of people, very social. We feel like we don't have our own private time or space. We're hosting guests on both short-term and long-term guests from May to October. And that's pretty full on, and it's buzzy, and I draw energy from it, and we get lots done, and it's exciting. We grow a lot of food, we harvest, process a lot of food, meet a lot of people. It's really fun. But I couldn't do that 12 months of the year. So the other half of the year, we don't have guests. We have a few. We have one sort of separate cottage attached to the house, which is self-catering. And that is open all year, but it's a bit separate to us. So we then take over the main house as our home again. And so for those 6 months of winter, we do get lots of private time and space. And actually it's that contrast which works. And so we get on with our other jobs in the winter. I'm trying to do this PhD. My husband is actually an academic as well, and he does most of it online, which is partly because of the pandemic. He's been able to do it online. And obviously living in the countryside, because we are in a very rural area, actually the work never really stops, because, you know, there's trees that need pruning and chickens that need looking after and manure that needs digging in. So, you know, it's not like the outside work stops.
So were you always this sort of, I'm thinking Felicity Kendall, you know, of The Good Life, sort of, were you always that, or are you sort of like have really learnt and adapted to your new life?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay, so there's a bit of both. I guess there was a kernel of Felicity Kendall in that my dad had a very large allotment when I was a child. And, you know, it was the 70s. And so he was into growing his own. He made his own brown bread. He made his own yogurt. I remember the yogurt, you know, sitting in the boiler, what's it called, the airing cupboard, setting overnight. And at the time, I sort of resented it, having to go and help in the allotment and taking my brown bread sandwiches to school when everybody else had, you know, chocolate bars and exciting things. But I think it did sink in. And I think some of that has stayed with me. And certainly as an adult, I've always enjoyed cooking, and I've always enjoyed making things from scratch if you can. But then I have learned loads. I mean, before this, we were living in London. So, you know, we lived a city life. Learning how to look after a large vegetable garden and an olive grove and an orchard and a section of meadow and a section of forest and, you know, where people, you can't just get deliveries like that or workmen to come and fix things just like that. We have to do a lot of it ourselves. Has been a very steep learning curve. I've learned a huge amount in the last 5 years.
So I was just thinking, really, I don't know why, about the sort of language, obviously. I mean, are you good, and do you speak languages, and how difficult is Croatian, or, you know, is it like, because I speak Italian pretty much. I mean, well,
you would be fine. Italian. You would be fine here, because I mean, Istria is actually officially a bilingual region. It's bilingual Croatian Italian, and that's because of the history. Istria has a brilliantly complicated history. It's a peninsula, it's kind of a triangular shaped peninsula, and over the last, you know, 500 or more years, it has been just chopped up and changed. It's been part of the Venetian Republic, the Austrian Empire, Italy when it expanded between the wars, Yugoslavia, Croatia. So it's a really complex borderland. And because of that, language is actually very slippery and complex. Yeah. And so most people here speak various dialects. So your sort of average person here will speak probably at least 5 or 6 languages. They'll speak standard Croatian, because they probably had to at school, or standard Italian if they went to one of the Italian schools. They will also speak at least one Croatian dialect, which is specific to their little part of Istria, and or one of the Italian dialects. And they'll probably, because of tourism, speak English and German as well. So it's a very, very...
Gosh, I mean, that's amazing, isn't it? Because obviously Italian is... I lived in Milan, and the Milanese dialect is just so different from Italian. It's not even similar. It's like the Italian for tomato is pomodoro, and the dialect is tomate. It's just like, yeah. Oh, and the mouse is topo, and in dialect it's rat. So it's just totally
completely different.
Yeah. One of the really, French, and
one of the really fascinating dialects here is called Istra Veneto, which is actually a very, very old, like 400 or more years old version of Venetian. And it dates from when the Venetians were here, which is going back, you know, several hundred years. But people still speak it. And we had some guests, some tourists came from Venice, and they couldn't believe it when they heard it. They said, "This is how my grandmother used to
speak." Oh, wow. Oh,
people
amazing.
Don't speak like this anymore, but they kind of recognized it from the past.
Amazing.
And that's very different to standard Italian. And some of those old Venetian words actually also appear in the Slavic dialects as well. So words like piron is fork. And I think standard Italian is what? Forchetta,
yeah.
So completely different. Yeah. And Croatian is completely different again, but everyone here calls it a piron.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that word anyway, the Italian, comes from some kind of, I mean, because obviously English started using the fork, didn't they?
Mm.
So I'm wondering if that came from there. Or did the English, or was it the Italians using the fork? Anyway, one or the other. I'm not sure.
Oh, I don't know.
It from them or they got it from us. I think, having thought about it, I think it comes from the Italians, because it was the fashion, wasn't it, in like Georgian times, for the two-pronged fork, which I think we must have got with the Grand Tour, you know, the Grand Tours, and sort of seeing that it, I don't know. I'd love to know more about that, because us as sort of foodies, I'm like, wow, that's an interesting thing. I've got to go and find that out, you know.
That's what's brilliant about it, because you eat very, very simple things that we take for granted. Like,
yeah.
Actually have these complicated histories that show you how, well, lots of things, but how parts of the world have long been interconnected, for one.
Yeah, I know that the four-pronged fork sort of really comes from the Georgian period, but I'm not sure why it changed from the two-pronged. I've got early Georgian cutlery that's basically two-pronged, and then it goes into later, you know, like by George the Third's time, it's going into the four-pronged fork. Anyway, there we go. We digress into forks, into fork prongs. So now tell me again, because I'm so ignorant, frankly, is about the sort of the conflict was it in your area or was it not? Or
actually, there's been so much conflict here over in this part of the world over the centuries that depends on what you're talking about. But I mean, World War One and World War Two were pretty awful here, right here where I am, in northern Istria. But the Yugoslav wars, or the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 90s, actually there was no fighting on Istrian soil. The fighting happened elsewhere, in parts of the former Yugoslavia. So people here are kind of quite proud of that they sort of, they see themselves as, you know, more peaceful maybe. But of course, a lot of people were sent to fight. So that's not to say that people here didn't go to fight elsewhere. They did. They were sent.
Are there Serbians there, or is it mostly Croatians?
No, it's quite mixed, actually. So after the, as a result of those wars, there were lots of refugees, actually, who came here from Serbia, Bosnia, various places. So actually, the population is quite mixed, especially in the towns along the coast. You know, in the tiny villages, maybe not so much, but in the bigger towns, there's a very mixed population. There's Albanians, Bosnians, and some of these populations have been here for a really long time, predating the 1990s by a long way.
Yes, I'm wondering what sort of cultural aspect that has, you know, on say food, you know.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, there's I think As a tourist, if you come here, you are faced, and this is sort of the subject of my PhD, but you are faced with a fairly standardized version of what is Istrian food. So Istrian cuisine is a thing, and people, you know, if you look at the advertising, the websites, etc., the books, you actually not so much the books, but you will see a fairly standardized version of what is Istrian cuisine. And it's things like truffles, really good olive oil, really good wine, cheeses, cured meats, especially the sort of Istrian version of prosciutto, which is called prosciutto, is particularly famous, and salami, and various pasta dishes, and then a traditional way of cooking meat in the fireplace in a big cast iron pot. Wild asparagus, wild mushroom, and certain preparations.
I'm getting hungry.
On the coast it's more seafood, so fish.
It sounds Italian, you know, what one unifiedly thinks of Italian food, which obviously is not you know, you can't say that's Italian food because it's very regional. So it sounds a bit like that, yeah.
But there's definitely sort of elements that kind of look Italian, because there's lots of pasta and there's lots of gnocchi, and on the coast you get seafood risottos. So that's as it's sort of presented and performed for the tourist. But then what's interesting, I think, is if you sort of get inside people's homes a bit more and see that private practiced cuisine, it's much, much, much more diverse. And that's where you can see really the influence of having been part of Yugoslavia, because you see dishes that were kind of popular across Yugoslavia are still popular in homes today. So things like stuffed peppers, stuffed cabbage leaves, salma, these are very paprika-y bean stews, there's a whole list. But this kind of Yugoslav cuisine is, well, to put it bluntly, is hidden from the tourist.
And why is that? Just because it's sort of like a domestic level, like an everyday food. I mean, I know in Italy, you know, until very recently, really, just thinking in the last maybe 40 years, well, recently, you know what I mean, you didn't go, you know, you really didn't go out except to eat meat out, because you never had it in the home, really. You never ate meat. So it seems like when you go out to an Italian restaurant, it's all kind of like big hunks of meat with no vegetables, and for a tourist you're like, where's the veg in this land? You know,
that's very similar here actually. The restaurant menus in sort of tourist facing places are very meat heavy often, very light on vegetables. I think there's lots of reasons why it has evolved like this. I think there's lots of reasons, but one is that, you know, after the Yugoslav wars, this area had long been a tourism destination, especially on the coast. The coast had had sort of mass tourism since Tito invested in it in the 1960s. But with the Yugoslav wars, it was decimated and the economy was turned upside down, and, you know, people had to reinvent themselves, reinvent tourism. And part of that was to distance Istria from the Balkans, because nobody wanted to go on holiday in the 1990s in the Balkans.
No, B is a bad word.
Yeah. War and violence. So tourism since then has very much positioned Istria as not Balkan, and Mediterranean instead, more westward looking, Italian looking. And so foods which might, you know, make you seem Balkan are therefore not on the tourist menu very often. I mean, there's a few exceptions, but generally fairly hidden. That's one reason. I think the other is that there is this pressure. I mean, as you know, like all around the world, you know, there is a certain sort of tourist who wants to try what's local and what's special. They want to try the distinctive thing that you can find only here, which is really, you know, special to this place. So therefore, to pick on something which is actually eaten across a huge geographical area stretching into, you know, Serbia, Bosnia, Italy, Austria, doesn't really cut it. So you've got to find something which is more specific to Istria. So there's been a process of kind of identifying local specialities and really flagging up what makes them different, what makes them local and special.
I'm thinking of that article. I'm sure you must have read it, and I've got a horrible memory for papers, but I remember there was an article about a Spanish, was it Spanish or Portuguese cheesemakers, and it basically almost like inventing this. I mean, they had a sort of concept of this cheese, but in effect it was really like kind of almost creating this whole culture around this food that kind of like was in effect not invented exactly, but sort of brought on and nurtured because of this local identity thing.
Oh, I'd love to know which paper that is.
Yeah, I'll try and dig it out.
I can't quite think what that one is.
No, I probably remember the details slightly wrongly, but it's about them drying this goat's cheese on straw in tops of their houses. And I'll try and find it. I've got it in my file somewhere, and I'll send it to you if I can find it.
Yeah, no, thank you. That would be great. I think part of the process has also been similar to what you said about Italy, is, you know, people looking back historically at what was eaten in homes and picking the things that were the special foods, the feasting foods. So not the everyday foods, but the foods for Easter, for Christmas, maybe for Sundays. Mm. And so that's the meat. And actually it's also the pasta and the gnocchi, because pasta and gnocchi were very special because A, they employed wheat, which was expensive and special, and B, they take time to make, you know. So that's why the menu today of your kind of traditional Istrian taverna type place has a lot of meat, pasta and gnocchi as the main dishes.
So you alluded to your PhD there. How does that fit in with that? Or what's the focus?
So the focus is, so as I've kind of alluded to, the Istria has become, especially since the mid-1990s, a different kind of tourism destination. So it's not just about the cheap sun and sea. It is now about rural tourism, cultural tourism, and gastronomic tourism. And there's been quite a concerted effort amongst regional policymakers and the like to make Istria a gastronomic destination and have a gastronomic brand, which I've alluded to already. My research, I wanted to look at, okay, who are the people who actually make these foods, who make the things which are becoming local specialities and Istrian cuisine. So my research has been, and I'm particularly focused, I've kind of focused inland, not on the coast, because that's what's a bit new, is tourism has moved to include the rural interior as well as the coast. And that's where a lot of these foods come from anyway, it's from the interior.
Sorry to be so ignorant, what's the coastal towns that we might have heard of, just to give us some focus?
You might have heard of Rovinj, that's become very famous in the last few years, actually, as a sort of must-see destination on the Adriatic. Is beautiful, Rovinj. It's a Venetian town on the coast, stunning, and it's been really kind of developing in a sort of boutique-y elite tourism kind of way. Poreč, Pula. I think when I was at school in the 80s, some of my friends went on beach holidays in Yugoslavia, and I think they couldn't have told you where in Yugoslavia they were, but they know they went to the beach in Yugoslavia, and some of them actually have since discovered that it was here. Poreč, Novigrad, and places like that on the coast. My PhD is with the smaller places you won't have heard of in the interior. And with the producers of things like the prosciutto, the Istrian-style prosciutto, the pasta, the cheeses, the olive oil, and also the restaurants where these things are sold. So in the interior, it's very typical to have two types of restaurant. You can have a konoba, which is it's often translated as tavern. It's a sort of traditional style village restaurant where you will get this sort of so-called traditional Istrian cuisine. And then also agritourisms, so farms or small holdings, which also offer apartments or a restaurant for people as well. And they serve a lot of their own produce, a bit like the Italian model. So I've been working with them. And what I've been looking at is basically what does it mean for them to have had this sort of gastronomic branding effort go on, which is very much tied in with certain types of regulation, with heritageization processes, you know, creating heritage lists, both at the national level and at the international level. Croatia is also part of the EU, so also involved in being making PDOs, you know, geographical indications, protected names, things. There's been this sort of various sort of, I guess you'd call them, you know, high level sort of efforts to define and fix what are the local specialities, what is the local cuisine, and then how does this work for my interlocutors who make it and serve it.
And what are you, so I mean, it's obviously a PhD, it's a lot of work, and you can't just summarize it in a couple of sentences, or obvs, as they say. But what's your sort of, because I think that's really interesting, because I'm thinking of these papers actually, which may or may not include this cheese piece that I've alluded to, but it's kind of like that, you know, these, you know, in effect, government bodies designating these areas of special interest or food of special interest. I mean, the French are really big on that, aren't they? With their, you know, claiming bits of food as sort of theirs. And yeah, and obviously prosciutto, which is it, is prosciutto? Do you know what is it? No, Parma ham. It's like Parma ham, obviously it has to come from Parma, doesn't it?
Yes.
So all of these kind of things. So do they find it's sort of a liberating process to sort of say, well, this is our food, or is it a stifling process to say, gosh, we have to leap these hurdles?
Well, there's definitely pros and cons, advantages and disadvantages. Being an anthropologist, you know, I'm sort of naturally drawn to the tensions rather than just the, you know, there's plenty of other people writing in sort of business studies and tourism studies.
Yeah, like, oh, it's all marvellous.
How wonderful this is. Yeah. So I sort of feel my job is to point out where it's not so wonderful and look at the tensions. And you're absolutely right, just going back a second, a lot of this come from France. So underpinning a lot of these sort of governance regimes or whatever you want to call them is the idea of terroir, the idea that, you know, a place can generate specific foods with specific qualities that are reflections of that particular territory, you know, from whence they come. And that really does underpin a lot of what's been going on. So, you know, I found the tensions. And so actually I found that in, and there's a difference between sort of, you know, rhetoric and practice. So people might say, I mean, people are very proud that you know, Istria is now recognised on the world map a bit, and as you know, recognised as being somewhere that has cuisine and is worth travelling to for the food. So people are, you know, proud of the fact that Istrian olive oil is winning all the competitions at the moment. You know, it's the best in the world. That their wines are slowly becoming more well known. People have heard of Istrian truffles, Istrian ham. Very, very proud of these things. At the same time, if you actually sort of look at, especially the kind of very small businesses who I've worked with in the interior, they're not the big guys. They're just about making a living. You know, reasonably decent one, but it's not like we're talking,
they're not millionaires, Rodney.
No. Then there are tensions, and the tensions sort of come largely, if you were to kind of reduce it to sort of simplistic understanding, is that let's call them the terroir based governance regimes are very much about fixing things, you know. So this food must have these qualities and must come from this place and be produced in this way and have these particular sort of cultural and natural connections to the place. Whereas, of course, people's lives aren't like that. And especially somewhere like Istria, we've talked about the complexity of the history and the people, you know. And
it's flexible, presumably, you know.
In reality, people are much more fluid and flexible. And actually, that's not how these things are practiced. So people's ideas of things like, you know, what is good taste? What's the good taste of a pasta dish or a risotto dish? What's the good taste of ham? How these things should be made? How even do you understand concepts such as kind of local or ours or home or homemade? They're actually quite flexible. I mean, not endlessly flexible. There are limits, but they're more flexible because that's the reality of life.
And presumably it sort of alters from year to year or pig to pig, or, you know, it's kind of like it's not a fixed concept, which is obviously, if you're a bigger producer, you've got time and investment in adjusting the bureaucracy of the whole thing to tick all the boxes, and I wanted to fudge it a bit as well, whereas in the smaller producers maybe they can, I don't know that they haven't got the time. They haven't got. I know just by my for myself. I hate paperwork. You know, paperwork's my absolute. I can't stand doing paperwork.
Nobody likes paperwork.
Nobody likes it. But if you're a big organisation, you have somebody to do that, don't you? To tick all the boxes.
Exactly.
So I wonder who's being more flexible with the interpretations. The big producers who can probably offer a few bob to somebody.
I wouldn't like to say it. I don't know. I mean, it's possible. But I think the sort of the one of the points is that the bigger ones, or the ones able to invest and therefore become bigger, are able to comply with the rules, more or less. And the small people just can't, because, for instance, to make ham and sausages, the sort of traditional, people can't see my air quotes, but like the traditional with air quotes way of doing ham or sausages, you would actually, you know, welcome the open window and the breeze coming in. You would, a bit like cheese producers out in the world, you kind of welcome the microbial colonies going on inside the room, the natural fire, we're just giving just the right amount, small amount of smoke. And so your setup for doing these things looks like that, and is a very, very far cry from what the regulations require. And that's not just the PDO regulations, but it's also just the, you know, wider sanitary regulations. So to invest in changing that is huge. And small producers just don't have the money. They just can't.
It's the same with organic, isn't it? The organic, you know, yeah. Obviously people might be producing food in an organic like way, but unless it's actually ticked off as organic, and there's obviously the the Organic Soil whatever Association, mm-hmm. Or the Soil Association, sorry. So mm-hmm. you have to leap the hurdles and pay a lot of money. I mean, I don't know how much to have the what do you call it, accreditation,
certification. Certificate. I mean, it's similar here also for organic here. I mean, there's lots of people here who grow food more or less organically. You know, they might use the odd spray if they have an infestation or something, but it's pretty organic, but they don't pay for certification because it's much too expensive. Similar issues here. But I mean, as well as the money limitation, I think with certain foods, there's also a kind of a more sort of values-driven resistance to standardizing and to commercializing. And, you know, they actually would say that the way they make their ham is better. And the finished product is completely different to what they would call the industrial version of it, and much, much better.
And I think the tourists, anyway, the sort of whole point of this whole concept is this kind of, you know, as you say, this ownership in effect of place and food in the same breath. Do you think the tourist or the end result of this matters? You know, in other words, is it like, if you're a tourist and you think, oh my goodness, that hasn't got the certification on it, so I'm not going to eat that because obviously it's not as good? Or do you think it makes no difference, or you think it makes some difference, or how is that perceived?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I think there's a big difference between how the tourist is consuming these local specialities. Are they consuming it sort of vicariously just through media, you know, before they've even got here? Are they consuming it in a restaurant, or are they buying it off a shelf? And it's sort of, it works quite differently, I think, in the three different if they're in a restaurant, especially if it is an agro-tourism or a village canoba where you're probably going to chat to the host a bit, I think the labelling certification doesn't matter at all. What's going to matter much more is that if you like the taste of it, and if you're enjoying the atmosphere, and you know, you feel like you are somewhere authentic, you know, then it's going to work, whatever it is, as you know, if you kind of believe in it and if it tastes good to you. If you're buying it on a off the shelf market, because some of the, you know, the ones that have been, you know, got PDOs, etc., are now stand out on the supermarket shelf because you can now see very clearly labelled and branded, you know, Istrian ham with all the right stamp marks.
Yeah.
And yes, I think your tourist will go for that one because that's their way of knowing that this is, oh, this is the one that's specific to here.
It sounds like a sort of airport like sort of purchase, doesn't it? Which is you're going, God, I haven't got anybody anything. Quick, you know, let's buy them some ham, you know, and some wine. And, you know, gosh, it's got the label on it. So that shows I was there, as opposed to that real experience when in effect you're in somebody's home. You know, like an agriturismo, you know, you wouldn't sort of turn around and say to somebody, I'm so sorry, but is this certificated? It would almost be rude, you know, because you do, I think, get that intimacy, don't you, of a guest sitting down in effect in somebody's home.
Yes, exactly. And some of the places really do feel like that. And that is that, I mean, it's interesting. I find it interesting because this is the home sort of the home style, the homemade versions of these foods were never designed to travel very far. You know, they were always going to be consumed by someone who basically knew the producer, or maybe knew someone who knew the producer. You didn't need a label. And you still don't. I mean, that's how it works now. These things are kind of quietly traded in, you know, unmarked plastic bags and paper wrappers. And there's no need for a label, let alone certification, because you trust the person who you're getting it from. Whereas the minute you have that, you know, great distance between producer and consumer, and they're anonymous to each other, then that's where labeling and certification and packaging of all sorts comes in.
So, obviously the local people presumably, you know, couldn't give a monkey's if it's got the certification or not, but it's really the tourists who might care about that. And it seems like that it's really packaged. In effect, you've got that distance between producer there anyway, because it's a packaged food that you might find with a label on it in a supermarket, which is, yeah, you know, is
I think many local residents don't care. In fact, many would actively prefer to buy the sort of homemade version as opposed to the packaged certified version, because they see it as better. They understand, you know, how it was made.
Is there a private knowing of that? You know what I mean? Yes. That sort of like, okay, well, we're the realists here. We know a thing or two, you know. There's tourists who are doing that. Yeah,
there's definitely a bit of that. And it's recognizing a flavor, and it's recognizing the social relationships in, you know, in which these foods move about. But Istria, of course, isn't a flat, homogenous place. There's all different kinds of people in Istria. So it depends a bit who you are. And I think, so some people, you know, for example, in the more urban areas where people maybe immigrant populations in those areas who don't have those connections to the countryside, don't have those connections to producers, they may not have access to those networks. They probably rely much more on the supermarket. It's really a bit different for them. And then, of course, there are the vested interests of people who were very much, you know, pushing for Istria to become recognised in Europe, recognised in the world through its iconic products, and for that, getting things like PDOs and heritage listings and etc. is very useful. So, you know, there would definitely be some people who see the benefits of that, and there are benefits, and it does raise the profile of Istria. It does bring more tourism to a certain extent. There is this, you know, so-called trickle down. You know, more people can benefit as more people come searching out the food, but it's not even, you know, and that's because Istria is not.
So who comes off worst from that? Obviously, we know who might come off better, but who are the sort of? Can you summarize in a sort of almost like a story that shows who's coming off badly from this? I mean, does something come to mind?
It's actually very hard to give one story and to paint it entirely negatively, because it is mixed.
It's pluses and minuses.
It's all pluses and minuses. And I think the things that are negatives are things which are perhaps sort of harder to see. And that's why they don't appear in, you know, business studies and tourism studies and things like that, because it's things like, you know, losing the taste of a food that you had actually grown up with and liked. It's about your skills as you know how to make something, a sausage or some pasta or whatever, no longer being valued. It might be or it might be you to do with your ethnicity, that you're kind of excluded from this idea of what makes Istria, what makes Istrian cuisine, because actually you're Bosnia and your food isn't like that.
That's interesting about that memory of taste, isn't it? I mean, you know, because it's a bit like you don't really know that that memory has gone until you taste the thing that you remember, if you see what I mean. You know that thing where you think, oh my God, that tomato just tastes just like a tomato tasted when I was a kid, you know, that. And of course, if you homogenize things, even if in, you know, i.e. standardize things, then that the sort of memory becomes the memory of the new, as opposed to the old. That's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, food and memory is a very rich topic, isn't it? And it's just, I mean, it's just and complex. People do have food memories. Yeah,
very interesting. Well, so you're nearly at the end of the process.
Apparently I'm writing the last couple of chapters, and I'll have a massive editing job to do still ahead of me, but I am getting there with the chapters.
Well, that is so exciting. And how long has that taken?
I'm in year, what year am I in? I think I'm in year, around year eight, I'm in year seven. Because I'm part-time, and they don't really like part-timers, and they don't really want you to do it too part-time, but I've kind of insisted because it's the only way I can do it with a guest house. You know, I only really work on this in the winters. I'm far too busy in the summers.
Yeah.
So
also, it's such a, I think it's such a feather in the cap to SOAS anyway, just to have some really interesting project, and for you to, for us both, you know, I'm a long time part timer, you know, and the MA sort of like still beating the drum for SOAS and saying it's a great course and people should do it. No, definitely.
It really is. I want to second that. It really is. And I did it part time too, which I think is really valuable because you have time to meet more people, time to really think about the issues. And really explore the literature. And it's so fascinating, and it's had a huge...
Yeah, impact. I so agree with you, because obviously people do it in a year. I mean, honestly, I don't know how people do that, because you, the papers, you know, what do we typically have? 4 or 5 papers that you're reading on each, you know, or each module that you're doing, which, you know, mm-hmm. if you're doing, I don't know how many modules they have to stuff in, you know, but as a part-timer, I was having to stuff in, let's say, two modules a term, because I did it over 3 years. Mm-hmm. It's actually still quite a lot. That's 20 hours a week, actually, something mm-hmm. like that. I mean, you know, with lectures and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Still quite a bit out of a working week if you're working. And to rush the process and to be able to get something meaningful out of that, or to go back and revisit, or actually, I'm a great sort of book reader. So, you know, like just to think, you know, the Anna Singh, you know, Mushrooms at the End of the World, and just to think, not just to read a chapter, but to go back and say, God, that was a really good book. I think I'll read the whole book, or, you know, rather than just dabble in it, because you're only otherwise getting this very superficial kind of view of the whole thing. So, yeah, no, part-time, I found definitely the way forward.
Really valuable. And you meet such great people, don't you? I mean, you meet people from all different food backgrounds, going into food maybe for the first time, but a lot who bring very interesting, diverse food backgrounds. I loved it. I'm still in touch with a lot of those people. In fact, quite a few have been out to visit us here, either on holiday.
Yes, no one to talk about that, actually. Now, because I think our appetites are whetted for where you're situated. But so tell me the typical guests, how people typically find you. I mean, are guests encouraged to work as well? I mean, or are they just putting their feet up around the pool?
Well, we don't have a pool. So this sort of goes with us being slightly...
You're quite right too, you know, because otherwise you're attracting the wrong kind of guest who's sitting on their fat bums expecting room service. Yeah.
Yes, actually, you hit the nail on the head. But very much also for environmental reasons. Yeah, they're hugely energy and water guzzling. So we don't have a pool. We don't have air conditioning. And this puts some people off. So we don't tend to get that many families, you know, who are doing the sort of classic week because they want a villa. They want a villa with a pool and a security fence, and we can't offer those things. So we tend to get different types of people. And there's always exceptions to my generalizations, but in peak summer, which is July, August. We actually seem to get a lot of youngish couples all over Europe and beyond who are just pre-kids and who are exploring and independently around the region. And what's really nice about that is they're really up for meeting each other. So it's quite a social space. And you know, we do breakfast together, we do dinners together, and people really enjoy meeting each other. And of course, they're not all that young by a long shot, but there's a, for some reason they choose to go on holiday at when they don't really need to, when everybody else is going on holiday in July and August, but still they come. And they're great. And they normally stay a few nights, maybe half a week. And that's also when it's hottest. For some people too hot. So then outside of that peak season, so early summer and autumn, which are just beautiful because it's usually sunny and warm and just gorgeous, but not so hot. And you know, in the spring,
the asparagus and the mushrooms.
Yeah. Oh god, in the spring, lovely. The forest and the meadows are just bright green. There's so many flowers, there's wild asparagus in the forest, so many birds. And you tend to get slightly older people, 40s, 50s, 60s, who really want to, you know, go walking, go hiking, go cycling, go and visit all the medieval hilltop towns, really make the most of the rural interior. And in autumn, we have not only the wild mushrooms, but also the best truffles come in autumn, the white truffles. So you get a lot of real food lovers coming in the autumn who want to go and, you know, try all these special.
Yes, because you're calling it a culinary holiday. So presumably the focus is really about the food, is it?
Yeah. So we grow. I mean, in terms of focus for us, in terms of what takes up my time, I'd say, yeah, it's 90% food related. So, you know, we grow a lot. We have a big vegetable garden, fruit trees, nut trees, olives. We have chickens. We grow corn for polenta. We collaborate with our neighbours on things like corn, potatoes and stuff. And we do a lot of transformation, so we do a lot of preserving. So, you know, we have gluts of things like tomatoes and turn them into tomato sauce to last the year, gluts of cucumbers which we pickle. So there's a lot of preserving and transformation. We make lots of homemade liqueurs and aperitifs and ketchups and cordials and things like stocking the larder is a big job. And then obviously we cook it for guests. So we provide breakfast every morning and there's always something different, you know, an interesting cooked dish. And we do dinners for guests.
So what's a typical breakfast, actually? I was just doing a seminar last night, actually, with a chef. So I was the nutrition chatter, as you can tell, I'm a chatterbox. And they were the chef, so they were cooking. We did a recipe from the Helmsley and Helmsley book, which is actually this one. And it's just chopped up. It's really simple, but it's sort of chopped up veg with, you know, with turmeric and cumin and I don't know, chard and tomato, fresh tomatoes, and then with yogurt and then with eggs, you know, and topped off with goat's yogurt.
Wow.
It's in that book if you've got that. It's really yummy as a breakfast recipe. But so I'm just interested in breakfast, actually, because seminar.
We have our standards that we always make. So we always make granola, a very sort of nut and seed heavy and honey heavy granola, which is very popular. And we always make sourdough. So I've made sourdough for you.
Oh, lovely.
Have a recipe for a crusty loaf which works. So we do sourdough and we make homemade yogurt and homemade jams. We have kind of our basics that are always out. And then I'll do something special every morning and it really varies. So I use the eggs from the chickens a lot. So we'll do things, depends on the season. I mean, I think if there's one thing that sort of defines my cooking, it's the season, because we're just seeing what's out there, you know. So in spring, it might be actually something very typical for this area, which is scrambled eggs with wild asparagus in it.
Lovely.
Which is delicious. Or when we have tons of tomatoes and peppers and coming out of the garden in August or September, I'll do a lot of shakshuka with poached eggs inside. We grow borlotti beans. They're not always successful, but sometimes we get a good crop, and I'll do braised borlotti beans, the kind of spicy paprika cumin.
Oh,
with an egg on top and some.
My mouth is watering, you know, because
oil drizzle.
I haven't had my breakfast yet, actually.
No.
So I'm like, I've got to almost like rush down. So I'm like, well, it's over now, Anna. So thanks for rush down to do my breakfast. Sounds yummy.
Yeah, so it really varies. And I sort of see what kind of guests do we have? What's the weather like? You know, what have I got in the garden? What's going to work? You know, when it's really hot, I'll do fresh things like just fresh chopped tomatoes straight from the garden on toast. Or I do a really nice one. It's a kind of very finely mandoline young courgettes, like a carpaccio with lemon juice, pumpkin seed oil, shavings of parmesan or something similar.
And gorgeous.
Rocket leaves, kind of just really kind of zingy and lemony and wake you up in the morning. So
are you a chef, Anna, as well, or are you a cook? You know, like I'm a cook, which is obviously I'm called Kate Cook.
Handily. I'm more comfortable. Okay, yeah, I know it's brilliant. I'm probably more comfortable with the label cook. When I did train professionally as a chef a while back now, actually, and I worked in restaurants a little bit. And my business in London before we moved out here was food. I used to teach cooking classes and do a bit of catering, different things in food. So I'm kind of professionally, I guess you could say, I've got a chef background. But my style of cooking is pretty homely. You know, it's not. I don't do anything chefy particularly. It's just food that I find, you know, pleasurable to cook and delicious to eat.
So with that sort of professional chefing background, it's not so overwhelming. I mean, in other words, you're not overwhelmed by, because I think as a, you know, it's a bit like as a cook, you know, if you're cooking every day, it's not a big problem, or even cooking for six. If you're cooking suddenly for 15, it's like that is a big shift up in your skill set and, you know, and also panic levels.
Yeah, that is something that you just kind of learn with experience. You just learn to be organized. You know how organized you've got to be if you want to have three courses, you know, ready by 7 p.m. or whatever. So you just get organized. It's as simple as that. And then if you're organized, you don't need to stress. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't stressful moments occasionally, but you just learn, you know, how to organize your work.
So are you planning, you know, like, right, this is the, you know, obviously we've got these guests coming and I'm going to plan to do this for breakfast or whatever, or is it literally sort of, let's open the cupboard and almost find out what we've got in and cook from there? Or do you have to be meticulous on the planning side?
I do plan, but I find it, yeah, I definitely plan. There's no meal that just I walk down to the kitchen, no meal for guests, for paying guests, that is. Different if I'm just cooking for those of us who are, you know, living and working here. Then I will just totally wing it. I'll open the fridge and just get something out and start cooking. So I do plan the guest meals, but I find it impossible to plan them more than a couple of days in advance, because I don't have the feeling yet. It's about 2 days in advance I start to get the feeling. Like, I can see what's looking good in the vegetable garden. I've met the guests. I've got an idea what the weather's going to be like that morning or that evening. And then it can kind of come together and I can come up with a menu. I find it almost impossible to do it before that for some reason.
Well, I mean, interesting, because obviously we're talking at the, we're hoping the tail end of the COVID times. So for you, that must have been quite tough. How have you managed to?
We adapted. So the first season, which was 2020, we did take a massive hit to numbers. We had, you know, huge, everyone cancelled basically in that spring of 2020. So we had a very, very short season. It was only about 6 weeks long as opposed to 6 months. So that was
Could people get to you, or was it just literally them windy?
It was a window when they could. So there was this window of about 6 weeks when, you know, enough borders were open in this area. And so people were coming from places they could drive from. So Slovenia, Germany, Austria, you know, the rest of Croatia. That was nice. We had a lot of domestic tourists, which you don't normally get so many of. So lots from other parts of Croatia came that summer. So it was a very short season, but we survived. Some businesses didn't survive. We just broke even, which was incredible. Then the following summer, which was last year, that season was bumper. And not just for us, but for everyone here, it was the biggest season anyone had had for years.
Wow. Do you think it was a sort of huge blowback, you know, from a sort of this kind of, you know?
I think so.
Was that one domestic again or from all over?
A mixture. I mean, there were some nationalities not well represented, like Brits, very few Brits last year, and very few Americans. I get confused. It's been very sort of specific times when Americans have been able to come, for example. But no, last year was just huge, and we adapted how we work. So we carried on with our meals, but we just put a bit more distance between people, you know, a bit careful how we were serving people, but we carried on, and with, you know, with certain measures in place to keep people safe. It worked really well. Yeah, we had a great time.
Well, I'm really pleased about the sort of bounce back. And so what does it look like now we're in 2022? What does it look like here in...
It's looking like it's going to be another really big season, judging by the bookings we've got already. But if there's one thing I've learned over the last few years, it's that you...
Yeah, don't count your chickens till they're hatched.
Fool to predict anything, exactly. So I'm, you know, we've sort of just got into the habit of going, well, we'll wait and see.
And have you had to adjust your sort of the thinking of how you, therefore you approach the future, if you see what I mean, from that?
Kind of. I mean, we do take it year at a time and month at a time, really. I don't know. I think that's been our approach kind of anyway. We're not massively into making, you know, very ambitious 10-year plans or anything like that. It's
I just wondered if you sort of get that sort of hunker down, you know, you're talking about sort of making the preserves and making, and you know, and all of that sort of, which used to be that winter preparation, you know, like drying the hams and all of the things that you would do in the autumn time for to get you over a winter period. Did you find that you were sort of, in effect, had the sort of mentality of thinking, aha, we better do a little bit more of this or a bit more of that to prepare for these tough times? Or have you
right,
just gone,
I see,
you know what,
you
we'll
mean.
Just see what happens.
I think to be completely honest, we've always felt quite smug because we've done that kind of preserving and larder stocking. I've always been into that, and it's just kind of, you know, gone over the top here. We've always kind of felt that security. So, for example, when there was the tightest version of lockdown here, which basically meant you couldn't, it was a bit difficult for shopping. I mean, you could, but it was a bit difficult for shopping. Didn't bother us at all. We had a larder absolutely full of stuff. And people here, you know, it's very nice. We live in a tiny village and people really help each other out. You know, we swapped food. We swapped things that we had. You know, we had polenta to feed the 5,000 from, you know, a very bumper crop of polenta the year before. So of corn the year before. So it just kind of worked. And we do feel, of course, we're very far from being self-sufficient, but we can go a long time without having to go shopping, which is nice. It's nice to feel like you can use up what you've got.
And, you know, self-sufficiency is interesting because self-sufficiency sometimes is the, in a way, a luxury to say, I can't get, I don't know, I can't get, what couldn't you get? Oh, I couldn't get dill or whatever it is, you know, something. But actually you could sort of say, well, do you know what? I'll just live on the polenta. So in a way you might be a lot more self-sufficient than you kind of think, without the sort of bells and whistles that we take as, you know, being what we'd ideally want.
Yeah. I mean, that has changed actually. The way I, living here has changed the way I cook quite a lot, because I mean, to an extent I cook like this already, but it's become very much accentuated here, which is you don't start from the recipe and then order in the ingredients you want. It's completely the other way around. You see what you've got in the larder, what you've got in the vegetable garden, what you've got in the fridge, and then you come up with the meal. And so, you know, there's no pomegranate seeds sprinkled on anything. There's no fresh coriander. There's no all sorts of things that just don't appear. And instead I use the, you know, what
you've got
here.
Yeah.
And it's a nice creative challenge, because actually it puts a limit on what you can do, which actually makes it more of a creative challenge, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, it keeps you fresh and keeps you loving what you're doing. So just we're sort of rounding off, believe it or not, an hour. Perhaps you could tell people where they could go and how they could book and all of those lovely things.
Absolutely. Well, obviously I'm biased, but I think A, Istria, and B, our guest house are very good choices for your holiday. I'm totally biased. If you don't know the area, you know, it's really worth exploring. It's largely Mediterranean in climate. So, you know, the climate's beautiful. the countryside is beautiful. Where we are, which is northern Istria, there's lots of hills, forests, olive groves, incredibly beautiful medieval villages on you know, picturesque hilltops. Lots of opportunities for walking, for eating out really well. The coast is not far away. We're 20 minutes drive from the coast, so you've got the sea and all the seafood. It's kind of gentle tourism, but people come and they just love it. They relax. They love staying in such a kind of quiet, beautiful spot. People can come and stay. As I said, we've got a self-catering cottage. So if you want your own space and your own kitchen, you can come to our cottage, and that is open all year. Or if you want to be part of the main house, then you just get a bedroom. And we provide your breakfasts and dinners twice a week. And then we recommend what you can go and do during the day and other places where you can eat out on the other evenings. And that's open May to October. And we do have, so people tend to come for a few days or maybe a week, occasionally a couple of weeks. And I would recommend enough time because, and I'm not exaggerating when I say whenever people leave, they say, I wish I'd booked to stay longer because there's always another thing to go and do, or, you know, more places to explore. Some people come for much longer. So we do also run a placement scheme, and there are people who come for more like 2 months at a time, and they come for a sort of working holiday. So we give them full bed and board, we give them a stipend, but they have to help out, and they help out with everything. So they'll help out in the veg garden, they'll help out in the kitchen with both the transformation projects and the preparing the meals for guests. They help out with hosting, serving breakfasts and dinners, looking after guests. And very importantly, they do also help with the housework, because obviously we are a guest house, so there is no end of housework. So they
home
do
from home.
Yeah. In a completely different setting.
But it's fine. Actually, you know what? Cleaning other people's houses is so much better than doing your own. So definitely. Yeah. And you know what? Sometimes I think holidays, especially, the working is really important, I think. I don't know. I don't like sitting around. You know, it's nice to have a bit of off time where you can read a book or something. But, you know, being, that's probably says something about me and being busy. But not being busy, but being physical is so important, isn't it? Don't you think?
Yeah. People come for different reasons and enjoy it for different reasons. But the chance to be really physical and active is one. I mean, either because that's how people are anyway, and they just can't not be like that, or they have a desk job and they really want to get out for a bit. But also a number of people have said, you know, it's just better than a holiday because you feel like you're living here. You feel like you're beneath the surface. You know, you meet people, you understand the place in a, you know, to a completely different level than if you're just a tourist for a week. So I think a really valuable experience. We've had over 40 people do it, and they've been brilliant. We've met some wonderful people who've come from all over the world to come and do it with us, and it's been great, and
it becomes a family. Yes. So it sounds amazing. So tell us where we can go and find out. Where's the specific coordinates of the website or details?
The website website is first stop. It's a pretty simple website. It is www.bolara60.com. So Bolara is BOLARA and then the digit 60. So bolara60.com, and that will give you all the information.
Thank you there. Brilliant. Well, Anna, thank you so much. I feel that I've barely scratched the surface. I've got all sorts of other questions and I'm like, oh yeah, but I value your precious time. So thank you so much. And everybody listening today, get in touch with Anna, find out more through her website, and hopefully we'll get lots of people enjoying your lovely, lovely, lovely food and your beautiful kind of nest. I think of it as a gloriousness.
It's been a pleasure. Really nice to meet you and meet a fellow anthropology of food student is always really, really nice.
Yes, and for anybody interested in that, they should look up SOAS, obviously, which is School of Oriental and African Studies, London University, and think about that course, which we both have really loved.
Absolutely, and I'm sure you're the same. If anyone is interested in that but wants to chat more about what it actually entails, feel free to contact me. I'm always happy to talk about it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that, Anna. And for now, everybody, goodbye. Thank you.
Goodbye. Thank you.